Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, KSFR has moved up the dial to 101.1 FM, and the station is even clearer because our intrepid engineers have been working very hard to bring that to you. Later in the show, Kenny Ausubel of Bioneers is going to be here talking about the new film, The 11th Hour. Right now, I'd like to welcome Natalie Goldberg. She is the author of numerous books about writing, including the classic Writing Down the Bones, as well as fiction and memoir, and her forthcoming book is called Old Friend from Far Away, which is a book about the practice of writing memoir. Welcome.
Thank you.
And before we get started, I would also like to say happy birthday to my wonderful, dear, generous, and kind mother. So you are going to be teaching a workshop at the Upaya Zen Center called Writing and the Natural World, co-taught with Wendy Johnson. What's the difference between nature writing and writing in the natural world, or the kind of writing that you're doing at the workshop, or is it the same thing?
Oh, that's a good question. I think nature writing, you end up writing about trees and the environment, whereas writing in the natural world, what isn't the natural world in some odd way? Do I dare say even plastic has become part of the natural world?
No.
Well, actually, I lived in beer can and tire houses in Taos for 20 years, and we realized that beer cans and tires, you couldn't get rid of them, so you might as well use them. And they became part of the natural world. We built with them. So writing in the natural world, I think, encompasses everything. Your natural mind, too, and how you accept things and how you see things.
So what is the difference between doing writing that is, you know, where you're, I mean, I'm not sure what you're doing exactly, but, you know, walking in the woods and things like that versus doing writing sitting at a table? Does different material come out of the students?
Sometimes, but basically what you have to write is what's going to come out, where you have energy and where your life is. But, yeah, like if I'm here sitting at this table in a cafe, I might pull in the yellow wall or the purple wall. If I'm outside, I might pull in some birch trees. But that might not be exactly what I'm writing about. I might be remembering something 30 years ago. And it might stimulate new kinds of energy.
And each of those things might stimulate a different thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So different places, though I say to my students, because they come and study with me often in Taos, and they say, oh, well, you have to live in a gorgeous place with mountains. And I say, no, you can write beautifully in Cleveland. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about Cleveland.
And our online Cleveland listeners should know that it's not all unbeautiful.
No, and it doesn't have to be beautiful. If all writing is beautiful, it gets kind of boring.
Part of this, it's at the Upaya Zen Center. Part of this is the practice of meditation, and I guess bringing that into the writing, or
yes,
combining them
somehow?
Well,
what I always teach is writing as a practice. So it's always been a Zen practice to me. Go 10 minutes. Keep your hand moving. Don't worry about punctuation, spelling, grammar. You're free to write the worst junk in America, because you need to be able to write junk, because people sit down and they think the first word is the beginning of war and peace. And if it isn't, they quit. And I think of writing like any other athletic activity. The more you do it, the better you get at it. The more shapely you become. Unfortunately, my shapeliness is my brain, which you can't see.
But you can hear it on the radio better than you can see the person. When you talk about writing as a practice, I mean, probably many of our listeners have read or used the exercises in Writing Down the Bones, and it's, as you say, keep your hand moving, don't worry about punctuation, just let it flow. Do you still do that?
Believe it or not, yes. I have pretty much dedicated my life to making writing as a practice. Now, I do write books. So what do I do when I write a book? I use writing practice. For instance, in a novel, chapter 10, okay, Nat, today Nell has to drive to Nebraska. She starts out at Fort Collins, Colorado. Go, 2 hours. And it's an adventure. Writing is an act of discovery. I know she has to end up in Nebraska, but I don't know what adventures she'll have on the way.
And so you use that practice of letting it happen. How much of your time, let's say if you're writing a piece of fiction, do you spend, you know, letting it out and doing the first draft versus the thing that so many writers talk about, which is the many layers of editing and re-editing and rewriting?
I'd say it was 50-50. I just let it burn out. I let out everything because I can't discriminate. When you're really writing, writing does writing, and you don't have this discrimination. You have this great faith and trust. And then afterwards, I read it and see what's alive. So then, for instance, later I'll say, you have to develop that Clark bar she was eating on her way up to Nebraska. So I put a little one, and I circle it. I take a blank piece of paper. I put one, go, 5 minutes, Clark bar. And if I get back to those first thoughts, the first way my mind flashes on something, which is much more alive than if I try to mess around. Oh, Clark bar, pretty, chocolate. I don't know what fresh new thing can come out.
It's so interesting. I was reading Edgar Allan Poe talking about his writing, and it was exactly the opposite. It was he was saying, it's an intellectual process. It's like architecture. You build the frame, you build the fa-. I read it a long time ago, so I don't remember the exact details. And it was such a different, non-organic process than what you're doing. I mean, it makes it sound like each piece of writing sort of has its own DNA, and if you just let it grow, it'll take its correct shape.
Yeah, it's trusting the mind, and that the mind is shapely if you get out of the way. But Edgar Allan Poe, there are many ways to ecstasy, or there are many ways to the empire. And this is what I've developed. And it's really a practice, and it's based on 2,000 years of watching the mind. So I'm not only working on my writing, I'm working on myself simultaneously.
So when you talk about 2,000 years of observing the mind, you're talking about the Zen practice.
Yes, I'm talking about meditation practice.
And so how does your Zen practice feed directly into the writing? I mean, they're both practices, but are they... Can you write without doing your Zen practice first, or is that a necessary part of your day?
Well, I consider writing practice a legitimate Zen practice like meditating. So it wouldn't be that I have to meditate in order to write. You know, when you're sitting, you anchor your mind with your breath, and you have, let's say, a half hour. And in the same way, go a half hour, and you sit with your mind and keep bringing it back to the breath. In writing, go a half hour. You anchor your mind with the pen, and you keep going. And whatever comes up, even if you're crying, laughing, you keep your pen moving. When you're sitting, whatever comes up, torrents of anger or sexuality, whatever it is, you stay in that position. So it's a practice. So it's legitimate Zen practice like sitting. You can learn as much from writing. But very good to bring both in. You know, some days I sit, some days I write. There are many ways to wake up. Edgar Allan Poe did it a different way.
We're talking to Natalie Goldberg. Have you talked to Zen masters about using writing as a Zen practice? I mean, does that go over in the Zen master circle?
That's a good question. Well, I studied with Katagiri Roshi for 12 years. He was a Japanese Zen master. And I used to go to him about my sitting, and he'd always interrupt me and say, Natalie, why don't you make writing your practice? And at the time, I couldn't put them together in my mind. But he was the one that initially opened me up to that idea. So I think that if you go deep into the Zen world, they're not as rigid as they seem. But Americans
often... Yeah, you don't have to sit on your mat with a straight back while writing.
Yeah, a lot of times they have a tea ceremony is a legitimate practice. Koben Chino did calligraphy as his practice. But when it came over to America, often we didn't know enough, so we got quite rigid. So maybe an American Zen teacher might not agree that writing is a real practice.
Interesting. let's talk about the memoir writing or the practice of memoir writing. What's the difference between memoir and autobiography, if there is one?
Yeah, there is one. Autobiography is, you know, begins at the beginning and it's chronological. Memoir is the study of memory and the way we think, really. And so memories don't come A, B, C. You might see this plant and suddenly snap back to the barley soup your grandmother made, you know, cooked 30 years ago. Memory works in a very different way than a chronological way.
So do you find that memoirs tend to be more nonlinear when they're done versus autobiography?
Oh, yes. Autobiography is much more chronological. And memoir, it could move any place. And often, memoir isn't your whole life. It could be a memoir of your reading life, a memoir of 10 years of your life, your memoir of your love of coffee through your life.
Now, with great respect, I can imagine that for students of writing, this would be very, very interesting and fulfilling to do. But is it always fulfilling and interesting for somebody else to read?
Well, see, that's the trick. A writer has to be a great seducer. So, yeah, you can do a lot of writing, but to get it on the page so other people want to read it is what the ultimate idea is, to make it alive enough and to let go of yourself enough to make things vivid. It's a very large thing. It's sort of you give your life over to the page. And if you can learn to do that in a really vivid, alive way, you can seduce people to read you.
There is this phenomenon, and I haven't gotten too much into it myself, but a lot of people are writing memoirs, and a lot of readers really want to read memoirs.
It's a new phenomena in our country that started probably in the 80s. Probably the first one I read was Patricia Hampel, The Romantic Education, where she wrote her first memoir at 30. Usually people wrote memoirs at the end of their life, like Bertrand Russell or something, after a great life. But Americans now have no patience, and they want to get it down now. So you could write a memoir in your 30s. You can write one at 18, what my life was like at 17. It's a whole new phenomena in America.
And what do you think is in it for the reader? What are they looking for? I mean, is it voyeuristic?
A little bit. You know, we want to find out. We're hungry about our lives. I think, especially Americans, we're pretty lost. And we are hungry about who we are. And we're removed from ourselves. There's so much being removed that writing is a way to have an intimacy with ourselves and come back to ourselves. And so we're hungry to study other lives and see how they lived, maybe to help us.
We're talking to Natalie Goldberg, and she's going to be teaching September 14th through 18th a course at Upaya Zen Center, co-taught with Wendy Johnson, Writing and the Natural World. Maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I was in some group, and I can't remember for the life of me what it was, but everybody had to go around and tell their life story and, you know, keep it brief. And what was so interesting about it was that the people who were in their 50s and 60s had a much easier time keeping it brief than the people who were in their 20s. And yet it was ironic because people in their 20s have lived so much less time than the older people, but somehow it seems like it's easier to get to the main points when you're older than when you're younger.
I think that's true. And I think that's true that as you get older, you can get simpler. You know, like songwriters, I've noticed, are more complicated when they're younger. Their songs are more complicated. And hopefully as you get older, you can hit it on the mark in a very few words. You just get simpler. Because you've gotten to digest more. You know, you're not all thrown in the middle of your life in a frenzy.
Right, right. Now, have you written memoir that's been published?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've written, I think, three. The Great Failure, which was my last one, is a memoir about Katagiri Roshi and my father. I wrote Long Quiet Highway, which is a memoir about my teachers, starting with grammar school. I wrote a book called Living Color. It's a memoir about my painting life, because I've painted as long as I've written and meditated for 30 years. and sort of came out with it in 1997.
Very interesting. When you write about painting, you can fill a whole book with that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Why do I paint trucks all the time? I had to look, because what do I know about trucks?
Oh, so it's not so much about the painting. Like, for example, in that case, it's about your memory of trucks.
Well, no, it's my memory of why I'm looking into why I paint trucks. Why am I drawn to them? And it turned out, when I looked deeply, it had to do with my grandfather.
And therein lies the tale.
Yeah, exactly. But I do tell, you know, I don't. It's not a book on technique, but there's 60 paintings in it. And I do tell you about my painting life, but I associate it with everything else. Isn't that true? Everything's associated with everything else?
I suppose, at some deep level. I mean, another thing, and again, it's something that I was wondering as I was looking at the beginning of your book and thinking about memoir and thinking about this whole phenomenon of very young people writing memoirs and older people writing autobiographies, and usually notable people who've, you know, done incredible things politically or whatever. And I was noticing that I have become, and I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but I've become less interested in myself than I was when I was younger. And I was wondering did you ever get to that when you were writing your memoirs? Like, oh God, enough of me already.
Well, yes, that's exactly it. You end up not writing about yourself. For instance, my memoir, The Great Failure, is about my father, my relationship with my father, but it's about my father, and it's about my relationship with Katagiri Roshi, but it's me examining who he is. So you can write memoirs that aren't all just about you. Oh, how boring. That will get no one to read your stuff. Mary Charlotte, I just want to say that Wendy Johnson, when I teach with her,
yeah,
she has a book coming out called Gardening at the Dragon's Gate. She's a very wild, and we're old Dharma friends, and I'm really looking forward to teaching with her at Upaya.
So how is that course going to go? I mean, what are people going to do? It's 4 days?
I think it's 5 days.
5 days.
Yeah. And we'll write, I'll do a lot of writing practice. We'll do sitting. We'll do walking. We'll also go out into the natural world. When you take a walk with Wendy, the world becomes alive. Like, she'll point out Cyprus, and then she'll tell you how Cyprus has a single root that goes straight down, and that's why they plant them in cemeteries. You know, it has a whole history, everything. But also, we're reading a book by N. Scott Momaday, House Made of Dawn, which is about New Mexico. He wrote it, and he won the Pulitzer for it in 1968. And it's really broke open Native American writing and had a real voice, gave a real voice for Native Americans. And Leslie Marmon Silko and Sherman Alexie and James Welch kind of followed. He broke it open for them. And it's about New Mexico. So we're going to use literature to learn about the natural world. So I'm very excited about it.
And this is all at the Upaya Zen Center. Is it a live-in thing?
Stay there. But if it's people from Santa Fe, they can just come over every day. Yeah, and stay at home.
The Upaya Zen Center, it's not a retreat center where people have to be quiet.
No. We'll have half days silence, but people have very, you know, they think they're going to church or something. It's very alive, and we'll be in the Zendo, and it's beautiful land. It's on Cerro Gordo. We'll be outside a lot, too, or we'll be sitting outside, and we might get in the car and take off someplace, maybe go to Black Mesa, because Scott Momaday wrote about Black Mesa. And, you know, so it's going to be a very organic, alive course, but there will be the grounding of a lot of writing, a lot of listening, and some sitting and walking practice.
I have to say, not too long ago, somebody taught a course called Yoga and Writing, which I took. It was just an afternoon. And doing the yoga postures and then writing was profound. I couldn't believe the things that come out of one, having put one's body in a different position and stretched in a different way.
Yes, I've done that too. I've done yoga and writing. I've done all kinds of combinations, canoeing and writing. It's fun. You can write about anything.
Now, Natalie Goldberg, your book, Writing Down the Bones, came out, what, 20 years ago?
Yes, 1986.
And it became an instant classic, and a lot of people's lives have been really changed and affected by that book.
Yes.
How does that, in turn, affect you? I mean, you've become sort of the big celebrity writing teacher. How does that affect your own writing?
I think it's given me an urgency to share, and also realizing that people all over the country and really the world, because it's been translated into a lot of languages, are going to be listening to me. So in a way, it's put me right my ass on the line, you know, so to speak. And it's invigorated me, and it's also made me very private, because often I'll write about my life in my writing, but it doesn't mean you know me. You know, but I don't meet people at zero. They've read a lot about me, and they think they know stuff.
And they think they know you.
And I don't know them at all. So I've gotten much more private, I think. It's impacted my life a lot.
Very interesting. And are there any ways in which it's been a detriment? I mean, obviously, success is a wonderful thing.
You know, people have this idea, you know, it's an American dream about success. It's so wonderful. One of the things that's made me more private, I feel a little intimidated. Like, for instance, at 10,000 Waves, I don't go into the general women's tub. I feel shy because people might say, oh, there's Natalie Goldberg with her fat belly. You know, I feel more exposed. And sometimes it's lonely because people project on you and have ideas about you.
That I can imagine.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So what's next for you? Do you have another book coming up, or are you...
Well, Old Friend from Far Away is coming
out
in February. I'm very excited about it. It comes out with Simon & Schuster. And I'm now working on a series of essays about, I'm not sure what, whatever I feel like writing about. But it seems like it covers my usual topic, Zen, writing, friendship, things like that.
Seems like there are a lot of people in New Mexico who really do combine the meditation, whether it be Zen or other, with their writing practice.
Yes, I think people are aware that it's a spiritual practice and that they do it, yeah.
And when you travel to places like the Northeast, is it more foreign?
Yeah, there. You know, sometimes it's sweet. You know, I just taught in Massachusetts, and those people were able to ground themselves in 2 minutes. And my theory is, I went around asking them where they were born and where they live now, and most of them they'd move maybe 2 hours away from their original place. And I think there was a real groundedness there. And so they were able to drop in much faster. And so they might not have as free a life. Most of them have full-time jobs. You know, in New Mexico, maybe there aren't enough jobs, but, you know, lots of people don't have full-time jobs. And sometimes that grounds you. And also living near where you were brought up, you have to deal with things that you didn't like to deal with.
Here, half the people here have escaped from something.
Yes, exactly. So they have to ground themselves in a different way. And really, writing is about detail. You know, Nabokov said, caress the divine detail. Mies van der Rohe, the architect, said, God hides in the details. And so you have to know the details of where you live. And a lot of people here don't know the names of the trees and plants.
A film that we're going to be speaking about in a moment had a section in it where the narrator said, high school children can recognize a thousand different corporate logos or something like that, and only about fewer than 10 native animals to the place where they were raised.
I know. It's sort of heartbreaking. Yeah.
Well, it is time to go. Natalie Goldberg, I want to thank you so much for being with us here.
It was a pleasure. It's just a pleasure. You're a great interviewer.
Well, thank you. And it's wonderful to finally meet you. And once again, from September 14th through 18th, Natalie Goldberg will be co-teaching with Wendy Johnson a course called Writing and the Natural World. It's a retreat at the Upaya Zen Center, and more can be found at upaya.org, or look them up in the phone book. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Kenny Ausubel about the film The 11th Hour. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Kenny Ausubel. He is the founder and co-executive director of Bioneers, and he is a participant in a film that is actually going to be screened tonight for the first time at the Center for Contemporary Arts at 7:30. It's called The 11th Hour, produced and narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you, Mary Charlotte?
Fine. It's wonderful to have you here. This is an incredible film. It's not just about global warming, although that is a part of it. It's about the whole environmental planetary scenario that we are living right now.
Yeah, I think what's unusual about it is it connects the dots among all the meta issues that we're facing now into a whole system, which is what Gaia, the Earth, is. And then really the latter third of the movie starts to open the window on solutions.
So how did you come to participate in the film?
Well, I met the two women directors, Nadia and Lila, about 4 years ago, and they did some web work with Bioneers. And we became very good friends, and they were just beginning at that time to work on this film with Leonardo. They had done two web movies with him, one on global warming and one on water, and he had always wanted to do a feature documentary about the environment. So long story short, a bunch of their folks all came to the Bioneers conference, and it sort of blew their minds. And around that time, they asked me to become an advisor to the film, and then they filmed, I guess, about 30 interviews at the Bioneers Conference, and then I helped them bring other experts to Los Angeles for further filming, and then I continued to advise through the post-production.
There are some major heavy hitters in this movie among scientists, but also philosophers and writers.
Well, part of what was really interesting to me about what they did is they're super smart and really intelligent and very sophisticated in their knowledge, so they got not just knowledge out of the interviewees, they really got wisdom. And they really let people speak freely and not have to speak in sound bites. And so I was really startled because you don't often feel that sort of depth of wisdom and authenticity, you know, on the big screen.
I was thinking while watching the film that there's something, we're in a place in media right now where with a film like this I found myself wondering who it was geared toward, because there's a whole large set of people who know a lot of the issues and problems, and then there's another large set of people who don't have the slightest clue, but it's the first group that's more likely to go see the movie.
Well, that's all true. You know, I think part of the power of Leonardo being in the film is that he certainly is mainstream, and a lot of young people are fans, obviously. So for sure they want to reach out to the professional class, to the influence makers. But I think they really want to reach out to young people and to anybody who will come to see the movie. I mean, the truth at the end of the day is we're one species. And that's really the in a way, the keyhole that we have to go through right now is to see ourselves as one species in the web of life and make that change. So we'll see. But so far, so good. And it was very interesting. They asked me to come to the Cannes Film Festival, which was the world premiere, to help represent the film. And it was, you know, two or three solid days of press, basically, mostly foreign and European press. And the European press particularly is pretty well informed, but reporter after reporter would say to us, I just didn't know how many different issues there are and that they're all connected and how bad things are. So even people that consider themselves well-educated probably don't know some of what's in the film, you know.
Well, it's hard to watch the film and not at a certain point think, we are so screwed.
Well, you know, the data are daunting, to say the least. It's very, very, it is truly the 11th hour. And, you know, the work we've been doing with Bioneers since 1990 has been to focus on solutions. And I think the film really does open the door on that idea, because, you know, 90% of the problems that we're facing, we actually know what to do right now with state-of-the-shelf technology, not having to even invent anything. And the balance of things, we have a very good idea what directions to head in. So it's really a political issue and an economic issue, and that's the powerful point that the movie makes.
One of the things that was interesting and painful in this movie to learn is that every ecosystem that has been studied in the world is in decline right now. Every single ecosystem. There's not a single life system that is growing and burgeoning and flourishing.
That's right. And the recent UN Millennium Ecosystem Report, which is the first of its kind, including about 2,500 scientists, basically they found that there is no guarantee that at the rate of decline that the life support systems of the planet will sustain future generations. I mean, that's how serious it is.
What are some examples of that? What is in decline?
Well, biological diversity. You know, we're losing, I mean, we stand to lose between a third and a half of the species, and not that even that we know what's out there. We know so little about what even exists, but within the next 50 to 100 years, the very web of life that supports us could be virtually, you know, dysfunctional, unfunctional. You know, obviously people are aware of, the film makes the point that 90% of the large animals in the oceans are gone, the big fish. And there's a whole food web. Right now, the plankton themselves are threatened, and that's the basis of all marine life. Because of climate change, the oceans are turning acid, which is killing off the plankton and the coral reefs, and, you know, it's all connected. So,
and the coral reefs play an important ecological role.
Well, they're some of the most fertile edges where, with the greatest diversity of marine life. There's an incredible project going on worldwide right now, actually, that my brother started, Jesse Ossibel, called the Census of Marine Life, where they took a 10-year window, I think it will end in 2010, to actually map the life of the ocean, because we have no idea what's out there, what the migration patterns are, where the hot spots are of the greatest diversity, and so forth. And they're discovering, quote-unquote, new species all the time. They're new to us. They're not new to the planet. But, you know, there's this incredible abundance and wealth of life out there that we just have no idea. They've been learning how sea turtles migrate from Japan to the west coast of the U.S. over a 30-year period. I mean, on and on. So by identifying where the greatest reserves of life are, they're creating giant, you know, conservation zones to protect those areas so that these species will survive.
One of the speakers in the film makes the point that 99.9999% of all species that have ever been on Earth are now extinct. What's the problem with extinction?
Well, if it's us, it's a problem, right? I mean,
well, if it's us, it's a problem. But if it's everybody else.
Well, our whole life support system is based on this web of life that's all connected. And so once you start to unravel the strands of this tapestry, it all comes apart. You know, some people compare it to when you flip a light switch, that if you push it up and up and up, nothing happens until you hit a certain point, and then the light turns on or off. We don't know how close we are to each one of those thresholds.
And when we hit one of those thresholds, let's say we get, so we're talking about the oceans, we get to a point where the coral reefs are really compromised, where the plankton are gone, 90% of the fish are gone, and yet we're still going along eating our sushi and eating our tuna and going to restaurants and going to the supermarket. What does the unraveling look like?
Well, nobody precisely knows what that's going to look like because it's very unpredictable what will fall first. I mean, you know, when people talk about the so-called climate skeptics, who are, of course, Hertz rent-a-scientists on the payroll of the oil and nuclear industries, but, you know, what they fail to acknowledge is that the military and the CIA consider climate change and environmental degradation the greatest national security threat in the world. So these are very serious concerns that people are trying to address on those levels because, among other things, what it'll mean is hundreds of millions of ecological refugees crashing borders.
Meaning that people who live in coastal areas that then become flooded will be homeless.
Look what happened in New Orleans on a relatively small scale compared to what could be happening and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people having to flee to Houston and all parts unknown all around the country.
Not to mention all around the world.
That's right.
What are the most vulnerable areas in the world that are threatened by global climate change?
Well, any coastal areas right now are very subject. And then, you know, you look at...
California, New England, Florida. Well, obviously Florida.
I mean, most of Florida is actually below sea level. So, you know, depending how rapidly this moves forward, Florida could be turning from a blue state to a very blue state. Bangladesh, I mean, there are countless areas. You know, the lesser developed countries in the south would be the most vulnerable. Generally, the belief, although nobody really knows, is that the northern climes are a little less vulnerable. But, you know, one of the Pentagon scenario planning studies that they did was for abrupt climate change, which we know has happened twice before, about 8,000 and 11,000 years ago, where the climate just flipped within a matter of a decade, and the Atlantic Current shifted. And if that happens, Northern Europe will basically, it will have global cooling rather than global warming.
So that'll go into an ice age.
Yeah, an ice age, right.
And the rest of the planet won't?
Nobody knows exactly how it'll play out. The poles could shift. I mean, anything could happen at that point. So,
now, there is still, I mean, you say the northern climes are perhaps less vulnerable, but the Arctic is extremely vulnerable.
Yep, and it's going fast. I mean, faster than even the alarmists predicted. But, you know, the point of all this is once you know enough of this, we don't really want to dwell on the problem. I mean, the point is, what are we going to do about it? And
well, there's two questions that have to do with what are we going to do about it. One is, what are some of these solutions? And we can talk about that. And the other is, what is in the way? And it seems not to be the will of the people as much as it is the just intractable political system that we live in.
Well, from my point of view, there are two big areas. One is simply ignorance, and that so many people just do not understand. I mean, the most basic problem in the world is that we have this delusion that we're apart from nature rather than a part of it, and somehow living outside natural law. And so people really need to get educated as to what the web of life is and how we're part of it and how to be part of it in a way that lasts. And just that's why I think a movie like 11th Hour is so important, and the work that we do, obviously, with Bioneers, a lot of it is about educating people, but not just to focus on the problem, but on the solutions. And then politically, I think you really hit on it, because the politicians are way behind the curve. The huge majority of people in this country want to make these changes, and there are political interests, and particularly certain elements of corporate power, that have been preventing this from happening. So,
and I always ask this question and nobody has an answer. Do those people not think that they are human beings also? I mean, they have children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren who would like to breathe and eat and things like that.
You know, I think that there are individually good people and conscious people within the system at all levels, but it's a system is the problem. It's a system that's based on short-term profit, on maximizing short-term profit, that does not take a longer view, and that once you're in that system, you're trapped within that. I was on the board of a public company at one point, and we wanted to do all kinds of good things around ecological farming, but it meant a 10-year plan. And because the company had to post quarterly returns on Wall Street, it was actually illegal for us as directors to try to do that, because our job was to maximize short-term profits. And then I think there are definitely malicious and malignant people within the system, or retrograde interests like the oil industry, which is trying to preserve its, you know, the fossil fuel economy.
We're talking to Kenny Ostabel, and the film is called The 11th Hour. It screens at 7:30 tonight at the Center for Contemporary Arts. The run starts tomorrow at the CCA. And you will, of course, be there tonight talking about the film.
I will, and tonight is actually a benefit for the Beaming Bioneers local Bioneers Conference, which will be held for the first time since 1992 in Santa Fe, which we're really excited about. And you know, we started Bioneers here in 1990 in Santa Fe, and then after 3 years, we outgrew the facilities, so we moved it out to California. But this year, the Satellite Conference, which happens concurrently with the main California event, will be here in Santa Fe at the, I believe, at College of Santa Fe. And so it's a benefit tonight to support all the great work going on in New Mexico.
Let's talk about the film in terms of, as long as I can remember, there have been campaigns, save the whales, save the dolphins, save the rainforest. Really, as they point out over and over in the film, this is really about save the human beings, because nature is going to continue without us whenever we go extinct, whether it be 20 years from now or many millennia. What about human life, human culture, do we want to save, and what do we not want to save?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's interesting because at the same time that people are the problem, people are also the solution. And there's incredible kindness and caring rising up all over the world, and extraordinary creativity and problem solving. And in a way, our greatest strength as a species grows out of having been hunter-gatherers for most of our existence, where the primary value is cooperation. It's not an individualistic society when you're hunting and gathering and having to provide for one another and share. And so cooperation is one of our greatest strengths, and that's what's going to be needed above all right now, is a massive level of cooperation that's going to be global, not just, you know, here in New Mexico or here in the U.S. So I think that's our greatest strength and what we want to save. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of indigenous knowledge. When we talk about the Bioneers, really indigenous peoples are the world's original Bioneers. This is where a lot of this knowledge came from, is traditional knowledge that was learned by making mistakes often. You know, a lot of traditional peoples have learned the hard way, but they learned.
A lot of traditional people have ruined their environments and made them unlivable.
And hopefully learned from that. And then, so there's a lot of ancient wisdom, and then there's tremendous cutting-edge science now, like Paul Stamets in the film whose mushrooms are able to decontaminate oil out of poisoned soil or actually break down sarin VX nerve gas, which is right up there with plutonium, as, you know, two of the most human, deadly human-made substances on the planet. So the solutions residing in nature surpass our concept of what's even possible. And the creativity that people are bringing forth everywhere in the world right now is just mind-boggling.
Well, there is this tension between the cooperation that you say is natural to our species, and obviously that's true, but there's also the fact that we live in a very individualistic society whose structures are based on individualism, whether that individualism be, you know, every person for him or herself, or every family for themselves or whatever. Do we want to preserve? I mean, I was looking at the film, and they were talking about retrofitting buildings with solar panels and with waste systems that are ecologically sound and so on. Do we want to still preserve a society that has skyscrapers and big cities and is based on this individualist model, or is there always going to be a tension if you do that?
Well, these are profound philosophical questions that I don't think there's any one answer for. I mean, what you're pointing to is that we have to make a choice as human beings how we want to live on this earth and with each other. And, you know, counterintuitively, for example, it's much better for the environment for people to live mostly in cities. You know, to disperse everybody all over the countryside would really wreck the land in most ways. So cities can be...
But and we know that from urban sprawl.
Exactly, exactly. So there's a whole green cities movement now that's very profound. Mayor Bloomberg in New York, ironically, is doing some of the best work in the country right now. Portland, Oregon has done amazing stuff. And not only is it good for the economy and the quality of life, it's attracting business, it's creating jobs, and it's, you know, making these the most desirable places to live. So I think it's mostly a matter of how we build, you know, but I think that urban life is very important. And people like to be in community and like to be with each other. A lot of people love living in cities.
There was an interesting moment in the film where they talked about how after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there was an extremely rapid retooling of Detroit to make the automobile factories into weapons factories and tank building and so on. And that took about six months, and the whole thing was completely in gear in just a couple of years. And the point there was that it really doesn't take very much time once the political will is there to make huge technological changes.
That's exactly right. I mean, we absolutely can do this, and it's a matter of political will and putting the economic muscle behind it. And part of what's happening now is that government, particularly federal government, is way behind the curve of big business. Big business has seen this next industrial revolution, and it's green. So we're witnessing that with organic food and farming. We're witnessing it with green building. Over the next decade, green chemistry is going to completely transform the chemical industry. So it's pretty inevitable that this is all going to happen. And in fact, the U.S. is losing the high ground in this regard, certainly on the technology front, to countries like Germany, Japan. I mean, it's really sort of pathetic. So at the same time, I think what's happening politically is that the federal system is so dysfunctional and corrupt that for the most part, the really positive change is happening at the local and the regional level. So we just started a Bioneers project here in New Mexico about a year ago called Dreaming New Mexico, for all of us as citizens of this place to come together and envision a positive future for what we want as New Mexicans, for both the land and for people.
To what extent is overpopulation a real, genuine, worldwide problem? And I ask this because the film talks about this, the difference between using the energy of sunlight that goes into the plants and you eat the plants and goes into, you know, animal life and so on, and there's an ecosystem involved where the energy source is sunlight, versus the huge population increase that has occurred since we started using what is essentially stored sunlight, namely fossil fuels, to fuel us. In the future, in a sort of happy future that we're looking at, where people are able to survive in a decent way, can we support 6 billion people or more on the planet, or do we have to actually do large-scale population reduction?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two responses I would have to that. One is that we actually could, we're heading for 9 billion, or those are the projections. And what's happening statistically is that actually in the developed countries, that populations are declining to the point where they social security systems are threatened because there aren't enough young workers to contribute to future to support the older population.
And they've spent the part that we've put in ourselves.
Well, they're wasting it left and right, but that's another story. But so most of the population growth is in developing countries rather than in developed. And there are a lot of future projections. Almost all of them agree that there are going to be huge plagues of infectious disease, the return of infectious disease with a vengeance. And given ecological collapse and everything else, there may be very serious die-offs, of a lot of people going down. Nobody knows. This is unpredictable. But the real answer to what you're asking is that we could support a population of 6 or 9 billion with green technology and green ways of living. There's no question. It's more a quality of life issue of what kind of world we want to live in. And what we also know is that the best methods of population control are to basically educate women and end poverty. And that is what, it's mostly poverty that causes so many births in this regard. And as soon as you improve the opportunities for women and the educational opportunities, they have fewer children and it transforms. So that's where our attention needs to be, supporting women.
Kenny Ausubel, tell us about Bioneers.
Well, sure. Bioneers is basically sort of a natural antidepressant, I would say.
Better than espresso?
Well, it depends on your taste, I guess. But, we started the conference here in Santa Fe in 1990 to focus on solutions that were really modeled on how nature does it, and with the basic philosophical underpinning of what we call a declaration of interdependence, that when you look at the web of life, everything is hitched to everything else, as John Muir said. But that, when you really grasp that idea, it means all the issues are connected. So you're not going to solve environment separate from poverty, for example. And so we started as a conference and did that for a bunch of years, and then it has evolved quite a bit. We do a lot of media, so we have an annual radio show, and we do a book series, and we have a very active website, and we're involved now with film projects like 11th Hour. And then we have a whole satellite program where we beam parts of the annual conference up by satellite, and we'll have 19 communities around the country and one in Canada participating this year in that, about another 10,000 people, I think, who come together. And it's partly what, broadcasts from Marin, and it's partly the local organizers putting together, what's happening, local work, basically. So I could go on, but we do a lot.
What are some of the most exciting? You're very solutions oriented, and what are some of the most exciting solutions? We have the mushrooms that ate oil spills, which I love. That's one of my favorite things of all time. What else are some of the things that have most excited you in terms of people doing incredible Bioneers projects?
Well, on the technology side, it's this whole field that now has a name that didn't have when we started, called biomimicry, the idea of imitating how nature does it. And we'll have a fellow named Paul Anastas this year at Bioneers for the first time doing a plenary, who is the father of green chemistry. And they've actually just created a whole department at Yale for him to chair, because this is really the next big thing. But by studying how nature does chemistry in water, in fact, a spider creates a silk that's stronger than Kevlar at room temperature in its body using nothing but crickets and water, there's tremendous...
Whereas for us to make Kevlar, it's a very energy-intensive process, to say the least.
Heat, beat, and treat, they call it. Huge, pressure, temperature, toxic materials. Nature would never do things this way. Mussels create an underwater glue that's now being studied to replace most of our glues. They do it in water at their own temperature. So there's a wonderful example of a bullet train in Japan that would go through tunnels, right? Very, very fast train. And when it would come through these tunnels, it would create a sonic boom. So all the neighborhoods around these tunnels were going crazy, and nobody could figure out a solution. And so somebody said, there must be a creature that changes mediums going from, outdoor air to a tunnel, right? So they came upon the kingfisher bird, which dives through the air into the water, and they imitated its beak for the front of the bullet train in Japan. No more noise.
Amazing.
So there's just example after example like that.
And when they get to where they can imitate photosynthesis, we'll be in really good shape.
Exactly. But I think the other part of this is the social realm, and there's incredible work going on in this regard, and that's a lot of what we feature. There's a fellow named Van Jones from Oakland, from the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, who's an African-American lawyer, and he's been working on a whole federal initiative now for what he calls green-collar justice. Because the truth is that environmental restoration is a huge economic opportunity and a huge jobs creation program. And we have, you know, tremendous need in this country for lower income people, for communities of color who are often economically disadvantaged, to actually create jobs. I mean, we know, for example, with energy, we could reduce our energy use by 50% just through conservation, which in a place like New Mexico means going around and retrofitting every leaky adobe home, you know, and doing good insulation and caulking. And these are good jobs that could pay a living wage and employ people who need the work and eliminate poverty. And, you know, so I think that those are the ways we really need to be thinking, too.
Kenny Ausubel, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Go see the movie, The 11th Hour.
And that's tonight at 7:30, and you will be there. And that's at the Center for Contemporary Arts on Old Pecos Trail. And then the film will run at the CCA starting tomorrow, August 31st, and will run, I guess, until people are tired of seeing it.
I think it may actually be at Regal Theaters at DeVargas. Tomorrow that it opens.
Oh, yeah.
It opens just tonight at CCA.
Oh, just tonight at CCA. Okay, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, including all the archived shows. All this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Bud Shank. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company tomorrow, we're going to have David Barsamian on in the morning, and he is the host of the show Alternative Radio, which we air on Tuesday nights here on KSFR, and he's also the author of a new book called Targeting Iran, so we're going to be talking about that as well. Hasta la vista. Ciao.